TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
The new Cold War that the United States unleashed against China. Yanis Varoufakis explains how China can win. Yanis Varoufakis is a former finance minister of Greece, university teacher, author in economics and technology, and engaged in European politics. A video of this candid and fact-filled talk before a Chinese audience has recently surfaced. How did China, on the flimsiest of pretexts, end up in the crosshairs of both Biden and Trump? And Varoufakis reveals the related danger to the U.S. financial system that apparently is so serious that this new Cold War might even turn into a shooting war. Yanis Varoufakis.
Thank you so much. And thank you for this opportunity to have an intimate, closed-door discussion so that we can speak freely. My topic, I think, is the most pressing issue for humanity at the moment. The new Cold War that the United States unleashed against China. This is not a shared responsibility. It is a decision by Washington, D.C. to unleash a Cold War against China. It started with Donald Trump. It was already in the making from the Obama administration, but it has been reinforced exponentially under Joe Biden. And the reason why I'm saying that this is the most pressing issue for humanity is because we are being quick-marched towards the precipice of a nuclear confrontation that the United States authorities knowingly are making a real possibility. And the question is why? The first question. And once we go through the analysis, then of course the second question of equal importance is, so what do we do about it? I enjoy very much placing American and British in particular journalists who are part of this propaganda machine, you know, Financial Times, Guardian, Washington Post, placing them in a difficult position with a very simple question. Why? Why is the United States declaring essentially a new Cold War against China? And the first word that comes out of their mouth is Taiwan. And I said to them, what about Taiwan? They said, well, the Chinese want to take it over. Well, I said, they always wanted to take it over. What's new? I mean, it was always the position of Beijing that Taiwan is a province of China. And at some point, they will have to fall under the fold, like Hong Kong did. Didn't Richard Nixon know that in 1971 when he was visiting Beijing, making friends with China? Didn't Clinton know that when he was inducting China into the World Trade Organization? Why wasn't Taiwan a problem then? What has changed now? They look at me, well, China is spying on us. The NSA is spying on you. I have, and that is the truth, and the line knows this, we have a three-point NSA tap on me. My phone, that is, 3 points means that if I talk to you, you are spied on. If you talk to your wife is spied on. If your wife talks to your child, your child. So I know that, they've told me that. So I don't believe the Chinese are as good as the NSA at spying. I mean, the NSA was listening in to Chancellor Angela Merkel, this was revealed. And then, you know, when Angela Merkel was told that, immediately she said, okay, do you want me to speak louder so you can hear me better? So it wasn't a problem, right? Now suddenly that China is developing surveillance, and I hope China is developing surveillance methods, because, you know, if you're being spied on, you need to spy back on them. It's the only way. One of my great friends, and I'm very proud of that, that may shock some of you, is Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. And Julian Assange, a very brave man, said to me once that, what do you do with Big Brother? How do you stop Big Brother? Well, what you do is you develop the technology so that you spy on him while he's spying on you. So counter surveillance is the only way of dealing with surveillance so that they know that you know that they know. And then I hear other idiotic answers like, you know, the Chinese are building naval vessels, they are projecting naval power. Well, I mean, of course you're building naval vessels. You're expanding your economy, you're expanding your capacity to project your own power. That is essential. But I'm going to be worried about Chinese imperialism when I see Chinese vessels outside San Diego and Los Angeles and Chinese army bases next to El Paso on the US-Mexican border. Until we see that, it is ludicrous. You just look at the map of the Pacific and you see American bases everywhere creating choke points for China. And this is their official policy for 40 years. And they have the audacity to say that China is a threat because China is... Anyway, enough time wasted on these non-explanations of the new Cold War. Now, the more sophisticated analysts in the United States would invoke the so-called Thucydides trap or Thucydides curse. That, to put it in very vulgar terms, if you live in an anarchic world, if you are a child, a boy, and you go to school, a very rough school, and there are lots of bullies, you should be the biggest and nastiest bully. Their survival as a nation and their prosperity will depend on their capacity to bully everybody else and from preventing anyone who is getting too big for their boots to become an equally sized bully. And they will say to you that there were bullies around the world, like, for instance, Imperial Japan, Imperial Germany, the Soviet Union, and what the United States have succeeded in doing is effectively eliminating them, annihilating them, getting them out of the way. And that now China is rising, China is next. And therefore that explains the new Cold War. Now there's no doubt that the deep state in the United States, and make no mistake, the United States is not a democracy. It's an oligarchy with elections that are providing the legitimacy for this one-party state to continue to exist. And when I say a one-party state, I mean one-party state. Take, for instance, Victoria Nuland. You may be familiar with this diplomat of the Washington establishment. Victoria Nuland worked for Bill Clinton. She worked for George W. Bush. She worked under Joe Biden. She worked for Obama. And no doubt, she was going to work again for whoever wins in November. Victoria Nuland is an example of the single state, deep state of the United States. Now, deep state, single party establishment in the United States is split along the line of two different conflicting views, neither of which is good news for China. There is the more intelligent, nuanced line of thinking. That which in academia is represented by that very intelligent man from the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer. The view is this. They are very critical of the inability of Washington to focus on what is necessary and their overreach. They think that the United States is overreaching. So they are very critical of the United States' role in, firstly, through Victoria Nuland, creating the circumstances through the coup d'etat against Viktor Yanukovych, the then president of Ukraine in 2014. They created a coup d'etat in order ethnically to cleanse Russian speakers from the eastern side of Ukraine, in order to provoke Putin into the first stage of war in 2014 against Ukraine, so as to push for NATO expansion in Scandinavia and, of course, Georgia and Ukraine. So this pragmatic viewpoint simply says that we shouldn't be doing this because that way we are pushing Russia into the arms of China. The whole point of the Nixon administration was to split the Soviet Union from China and therefore win the Cold War. So they are critical of the support of Ukraine and of Israel, because they think that this simply disorients the United States policy. It creates alliances amongst Americans' enemies, like alliances between Russia and China, Iran and Russia, and so on. And that this is silly politics because the enemy is China. And China needs to be contained. And if you ask them, why does China need to be contained? China doesn't have a history of imperialism. China has absolutely no interest in building military bases on the US-Mexican border, in taking, you know, naval power and projecting it to San Diego or Los Angeles or San Francisco. China doesn't want that. China wants to trade. You know what they say? Yes, we agree. But if we let China become a regional superpower in the Pacific area, in its own area, in its backyard, if we allow China, for instance, to become dominant in the South China Sea and in the Indian Ocean, then China in the future will start trying to do what we have done. And they will become an imperialistic force in the Western Hemisphere, which for them is the Americas. This is what they say. So that's one line of argument. The second line of argument is the opposite argument, that the United States must be a bully everywhere, all over the world, including in Europe, including the Ukraine. I have been told that by somebody who was very high up in the Bush administration and who was very high up in the chain of command of NATO in Brussels, an American Republican. He said to me that we need to expand NATO against the interests of the Europeans. He was clear, against the interests of the Europeans. And I said to him, Bob, why? He said, because of three reasons. First, because we must be in Europe, the United States, to keep ourselves in. Number one reason he gave me. Number two, to keep the Germans down. Look at the price of electricity in Germany today as a result of the war in Ukraine. The German industrial machine is finished, kaput. As a result, not just of that, but that is one of the reasons. And thirdly, to keep the Russians out. You know, if you were in the corridors of power in Washington, D.C., this is the discussion you would hear. The containment of China, the choking of China, is common ground for all of them. They simply disagree on how to do it best, whether to do it through the war in Ukraine or, as Trump suggests, end the war in Ukraine and concentrate on China. But I think that that story that I've given you so far is incomplete. Why did the Clinton administration and the Bush administration after that were so gung-ho about trading with China? Why did they not start the new Cold War against China in the 1990s, in the year 2000, in 2004, 2005, 2008? Why was it only around 2014 that this establishment decided to unleash the war against China? One explanation is that the Clinton administration people could not see that China would develop to the extent that China developed, that it would become so big. I don't believe that. I never believe explanations which presume the stupidity of the people involved. I don't believe that these people were stupid. And I don't believe that they didn't see that by shifting half of American manufacturing to the east coast of China, that, you know, that China would not grow and develop. They knew it. They were celebrating it. I remember, you know, for years hearing that, you know, capitalism is fantastic because look at China. The moment it introduced the market economy, they become a superpower. So they knew it and they wanted it. Why don't they want it now? Why is it suddenly choking points and containment and putting a boot on their neck? What really changed? For me, the essence of the pursuit of a new Cold War against China by the United States, by the way, Europe is irrelevant. Europe is simply doing as it's told. Europe doesn't want to unleash a Cold War against China, but, you know, they get the email from Washington, D.C., do it, and they do it. Against their interests and against their wishes. So don't care about the Europeans. It's Washington. If you were somebody like, you know, a strategic thinker like Henry Kissinger, who is now dead, but you know, this is the example of the deep-thinking American official. What would you really be worried about? Since I mentioned Kissinger, let me stick to him for a moment. The year was 1970. Kissinger, at the time, who was working for President Nixon, you'll recall, was not the foreign minister, was not in the State Department yet. He was the head of the National Security Council, and he was the National Security Advisor to the American president. And he was the epitome, all his life, of American strategic thinking, the thinking of that one-party state, the deep state of the United States. Being a smart man, when he saw the macroeconomic statistics, and he saw that from 1968 onwards, America, for the first time since the 1930s, had become a deficit country. For the first time in its history, since it became a superpower or an important power in the mid-war period, and certainly since the 1950s, when it was the only superpower in terms of economic superpower, the United States slipped from being a surplus country, from having a surplus in its trade balance, to having a deficit. And Kissinger was worried, because he knew that, historically speaking, every empire that went from being a surplus to a deficit economic entity started fading. So he got together his people at the National Security Council, and he asked them a simple question. What should we do in order to retain our hegemony now that we are a deficit country? And he said to the people, go away and think about it, and I want from each one of you half a page of a note. Very interesting, right? Not 20 pages, half a page. Not a page, half a page. This is how Kissinger worked. And these were very smart people, right? Most of them came back and gave a very Germanic answer. If we have a deficit, we must cut down our expenditure, we must increase interest rates, and so on and so forth, in order to reduce imports and bring about a balance between exports and imports to eliminate our trade deficit. One man, in his half a page, which I actually acquired in the process of writing a book 15 years ago, typewritten half a page, he said, what we must do, we must treble our deficit. We have a deficit which is bad. We must make it three times as big and make the capitalists of the rest of the world pay for it. Which is exactly what happened. The United States should increase its deficit and use it to create aggregate demand for the net exports of Germany and Japan. And later on, China. Because it is the trade deficit of the United States that sucks into the United States your aluminium, your electric vehicles, deficit dollars, like IOUs. And, you know, when people ask Paul Volcker, but will that not affect the value of the dollar? He said, no, not as long as it is the only world reserve currency, the only currency that has demand, people demand it, even if they don't want to buy anything from the country which is producing it, which is printing it. So if you are today somebody of a mind comparable to Kissinger's, then you know that the reason why the United States is so hegemonic, why it can afford to be the big bully around the world, is because of the monopoly of the payment system. Then you look at the rise of what I call cloud capital in the United States and China, the algorithmic capital on which big tech is built, which is a new form of capital because, unlike other forms of capital, which are always a means of production. A robot, a tractor, is something you produce to produce something else. This is not a produced means of production. It's an artificial means of behavioral modification. That's what Alibaba is. That's what TikTok is. That is what Tencent is. That is what, of course, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and so on. They are capital goods that create non-markets, platforms that look like markets but are not markets, which allow the owner of that cloud capital to bring us in as buyers, as sellers, as influencers, as opinion makers, as simply consumers of entertainment, and charge all of us a form of rent. That's enormous power that the ownership of this cloud capital confers to the owners of cloud capital. Now, there are two countries in the world that have a lot of concentrated cloud capital. One is the United States and the other is China. And the reason why you have it here is because you banned Silicon Valley. Europe didn't ban Silicon Valley, so we all depend on Google, Facebook, Meta, all that. And we didn't develop our own cloud capital. So there is American cloud capital and there is Chinese cloud capital. Chinese cloud capital has an advantage over American cloud capital. This is something you've got to understand. I mean, your technology is not better than the Americans. In some things, you have gone beyond American capabilities. But in other things, the Americans are bigger and better and faster than you are at this stage. No, it's not a technological advantage that you have. It is a political advantage and an organizational advantage. Here in China, the People's Bank, the Central Bank of China, controls the bankers. In the United States, the bankers control the central bank. They own the central bank. They created the central bank. The central bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve, was created by J.P. Morgan. It was not the other way around, okay? It's important to understand the institutional differences between our countries and the United States. The United States is a very, very strange place. So, cloud capital, Silicon Valley, in the United States, and finance don't work together. Apple Pay exists, Google Pay exists, so like WeChat, you can pay through Apple Pay, but a large segment of that money goes to Wall Street as a rent. So there is a class, some like class war, between the fiefdom of Wall Street on the East Coast and the fiefdom of cloud capital on the West Coast. They're clashing. That clash doesn't happen in China, because both your finance sector and your big tech or cloud capital sector are under the Communist Party. I'm being very honest and frank with you. And that's a good thing. That is an advantage. Now, go back to Washington. You're looking at that and you think, this superhighway that these Chinese have built is a clear and present danger to my hegemony. That's why they have the CHIPS Act, because they want to reduce your capacity to invest in this superhighway and make it attractive for everybody else. This is why they are creating circumstances of choking anyone outside the United States who wants to trade with China, because they don't want this superhighway. So it's not that China is getting bigger. It is not that China is spying. It is not Taiwan. It is that China has built a digital cloud capital based superhighway for payments, which is a clear and present danger to the monopoly of the dollar payment system, which is the only reason why the United States is hegemonic. So the question is, what do we do about that? Allow me just to say four things very quickly. The first thing you need to do is you must reduce your dependency on the American trade deficit. But allow me as a macroeconomist to say that you can only do this if you increase the wage share in this country. The amount of money which is essentially ending up in the pockets of the working class. The working class and the petty bourgeoisie and the middle class in this country. The only way of maintaining this investment and maintaining the growth rate without dependency on the American trade deficit is by boosting aggregate demand domestically. And your digital payment system is a way of doing it. I can discuss this later if you want. That's the number one thing you need to do. Reduce your dependency on the American trade deficit. Secondly, you need to appeal through soft power, through engagement with the local communities in the global south. Building a factory or some infrastructure or some energy hub in Ethiopia or in Namibia or wherever, it contributes to the development of the local country. But you've got to engage with the local community. Yeah. You have to remember your Marx, that there is class conflict happening in Namibia, in the Congo, in Ethiopia. And the local ruling class is destroying the prospects of the local working class. And the Chinese, I know you don't want to interfere in a party political level, but the people of Namibia must understand that China and Chinese business and the Chinese presence are their allies, not the allies of their oligarchy. That's how you win hearts and minds in Africa. You need to do the same in Europe. Because in Europe, there is a concerted effort to turn the people of Europe against the Chinese, along the lines of pure racism, xenophobia, okay? And the fourth thing, soft power within the United States. We must think together, and I say we. I'm not Chinese, but I have an interest in ending the Cold War. Because it is in the interest of humanity to avoid, firstly, nuclear confrontation, and secondly, to find a way of communicating and collaborating to end the very fast march of humanity towards a climate catastrophe. Without cooperation, it can't happen. We cannot succeed in saving our planet. So this is why I'm saying we. It is important to approach American progressives, because they don't understand that trade wars are class wars. That the moment you have a trade war being imposed on China, the American working class is going to suffer. Some jobs may be saved through tariffs if they recreate some manufacturing job, but that won't work. It is not a situation where, you know, you stop a few BYD cars from coming to the United States and suddenly there will be more manufacturing jobs in Ohio. That is idiocy. But we need to convince the progressives in the United States that their interests are in de-escalating the new Cold War between the United States and China. Thank you.
And that was Yanis Varoufakis with 4 points of advice for his Chinese audience on how to end the Cold War that the U.S. has imposed on them. Varoufakis is a former finance minister of Greece, university teacher, author in economics, and engaged in European politics. The video of this talk was recorded just before the U.S. November 24 elections, and it is 12 precious minutes longer than this radio program. I highly recommend you find it on YouTube under the title "The New Cold War That the United States Unleashed Against China," Yanis Varoufakis. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening.